special treat for you on the program today. My friend and co-host for the afternoon. Well, you're always my friend, but you're my co-host for the afternoon, former eGov administrator, now with the U.S. Cyber Challenge, Karen Evans. It's wonderful to see you.
Well, thank you for having me back, Francis. I'm excited about today.
I'm pleased that you're here. You look terrific, and I'm glad that you are here. We start, as we do every Wednesday, with Pentagon solutions. A lot of the debate about the Pentagon's budget situation right now is revolving around readiness. The Joint Chiefs of Staff expected to use that word and that concept many times over tomorrow as all four of them go to testify to the Senate Armed Services Committee. Readiness is our topic on Pentagon solutions today. Admiral John Harvey, U.S. Navy retired, former commander of Fleet Forces Command is my guest today, and it's terrific to have you here, Admiral. Thanks for coming in. If anybody knows about readiness, it is you, sir, and I thank you for coming in today.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here with you and Karen today.
You're writing on the War on the Rocks blog under the headline, Get Real on Military Readiness. Can I infer from that title that you think that we're not being real about it right now?
Well, I think we have to have a more nuanced view in the readiness discussion than has been generally the case in the past. I noticed over the past year since I've retired that as I watched the dialogue primarily outside, it was left with we're either ready or we're not. And, you know, the reality of this, it's not a binary situation. There's multiple stages of where the forces are getting ready to deploy, and so they need to be ready for certain things in that journey to deployment ready. And so what I tried to do was bring in the idea that you need to think about not just are we ready or not, but we need to think about, okay, ready for what? Mm-hmm. And then how long do we have to get ready? In our best judgment, and then how long do we need to stay ready for certain things in certain levels of the force? And this is different. You know, you get a different solution in the Army, the Marine Corps, the Navy, and the Air Force. So it's a much richer discussion than has been had.
One thing that Washington is awash in, and you allude to this in your piece, is policy documents that try to detail some of the elements that you just outlined when it comes to readiness. But you write about this progression of documents that we have put the force structure cart before the strategic objectives horse. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we talk with great intensity and emotion about how big or how small should the Army be? How many ships should there be in the Navy? How many wings in the Air Force and so on? Yet before you can get to that answer, you have to really get to the grips of, okay, what do we want this Army to be able to do? What do we want out of our Navy? What do we expect out of our Air Force? So you got to take this look around you. The world has changed dramatically over the last 10 years. Project as best you can and make some value judgments about here's what America expects and here's what America is willing to pay for this, and bring those together and say, okay, here's what we now see as a kind of a Navy for our future. And then what do you want that Navy to be ready to do and by when? And so before you say we need 50 ships, you got to get to what are those ships supposed to do? Where do you want them to be? How long? And what capability do you think we should have to deal with the threats and issues that we see in the future?
Is the appropriate platform for that the Quadrennial Defense Review that the Defense Department's working on now, or is there some other place where that concept should live?
Well, the owner is the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States. And so he's informed, obviously, by the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State and his executive branch. But also Article 1, Section 8, the Congress has a little voice in this whole thing. And so they have to be part of this discussion as well. And so it's a multiplayer discussion, which makes it very, very difficult because the politics are intense. The sums are huge and the outcomes are really, really important. But to your original question, I think the QDR, this one, in the past, they've kind of degenerated into here's why we need to keep what we've got and keep it on into the future. And they really haven't brought too much clarity to the situation. I think timing now is such that with the budget declines sort of in the future, staring everybody in the face, with Secretary Hagel having kind of outlined what he thinks is important, I think this QDR offers an opportunity to actually have an impact and make a difference.
Well, and when you talk about ready for what, to me that really is a risk-based approach. So this is where the intelligence community and the information that comes from the intelligence community is going to try to inform this from a congressional standpoint and the commander-in-chief standpoint. And so I guess my question is it real obvious to the citizen what the policy is or what the risk is that the commander-in-chief is signing up for when they say this is what we want in readiness.
Yeah, I don't think it is obvious. And so I think and that's a great question, because if you can't explain this, when all is said and done, here's what we need to have, here's what we need to pay for, and here's why. If you can't explain that in terms that the American people will understand and accept, they are not going to support it. And just as we saw with the almost Syrian event, I think the American people didn't understand what the president was really trying to do. And they just said, no, we don't support this one right now. So you've got to do this, when all is said and done, in a way that reaches the taxpayers and makes sense to them, and they will give voice through Congress, whether they support it or not.
You talked about the QDR previously being a vehicle to explain why we should keep what we've got. I see more willingness from OSD, especially considering Secretary Hagel's remarks at CSIS yesterday, to change that than I do from Congress. I see Senator Reid about to bring up the 2014 NDAA, or the next one, that's at a higher level than the Budget Control Act caps. And so that says to me Congress isn't willing to think about the constraints, the new normal under which the Defense Department will live.
Yeah, I think Secretary Hagel, I read that speech in detail last night, and then also when he rolled out his strategic choices and management review several months ago. And so you see him on this journey to this, an acceptance of, this is the reality I've got. I've got to play the hand I'm dealt. Mm-hmm. And so this is how I intend to play it. This is what makes sense.
The definition of readiness, as you put it in this piece, military readiness is a measure that pertains to the relationship between the military objective to be achieved and the available time required to generate the appropriate capability. That's about the most eloquent definition of readiness that I've read. When you express it that way, it doesn't seem like a hard concept to get. It seems like by that measure, it has to be fluid and can't be binary, as you referred to it earlier.
Yeah, I think we had a great example the other day. General Ray Odierno, the Army's chief of staff, was making the point publicly that said, I have two of my brigade combat teams that are not forward deployed to Afghanistan. Two of my brigade combat teams out of the rest of the Army are the only ones that are ready for what we would call full spectrum operations, you know, combined arms ops, ready to go anywhere and do anything. Well, he's got a total in the Army about 45 brigade combat teams. We have a number of them deployed in Afghanistan, a number getting ready to. So we have two of the remainder. Well, okay, how many do you need?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it 10? Was it 15? Was it 20? I think that's the discussion I think you need to bring into this. It's maybe two's wrong, perhaps, probably, but what's right?
Mm-hmm.
What's too many? If I have 30, I've spent an awful lot of money having an extraordinary number of our great soldiers ready and sort of on a 10-day notice, and they just sit there.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been the best expenditure of those very scarce and increasingly scarce readiness funds?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I talk about when I say I think we've got to get to less of the binary thing and more of the what do we need to be able to do and what's a reasonable risk decision you make to support that.
My friend and colleague here at Federal News Radio tends to always ask a question when anything is numbered. He always says, compared to what? And it sounds like that applies in this case.
I think that's really the way of the future here. I mean, we're going to be driven to this by the reality of the budget. You're not going to be able to keep every brigade combat team ready for full spectrum operations all the time. You're not going to have every ship ready to sail on 5 days' notice or every air wing ready to deploy. You're going to have to make some value judgments, some risk-informed value judgments about here is a reasonable posture to maintain based on what we see in the world around us, what we see coming, what the president has directed us to be able to do, and what Congress is willing to support fiscally.
You have some thoughts about how we go about doing that, and we'll talk about those when we come back on Pentagon Solutions on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My guest is Admiral John Harvey, U.S. Navy retired, writing in the War on the Rocks blog. My co-host today is Karen Evans, and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today is Admiral John Harvey, U.S. Navy retired, former commander of Fleet Forces Command, and he's writing about readiness. in the War on the Rocks blog, and continuing our conversation with my guest co-host today, Karen Evans, you write about the current configuration of readiness and how people are thinking about it, Admiral. You write, geographic combatant commanders are expressing their very broad goals here. Each CCDR develops plans and executes operations with the minimal required cooperation between them. CCDRs don't come to the table with resource constraints in mind, but with operational requirements to be filled. Six separate geographic plans and three separate functional plans register force requests first. So that means that any number of different and disparate requirements and wishes are coming to the table, are coming into the Pentagon from all over the world. What's the result of that as it applies to what we've talked about so far?
Well, the four services, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps, they operate from budgets that were started about 2 years prior to the year of execution. And so they receive then these signals, this demand for forces is actually the term of art, from the combatant commanders, say, I need two battle groups, two carrier strike groups in Central Command in the Persian Gulf area. Oh, by the way, I need two in the Pacific. I need – well – when you only have nine operational carrier strike groups, it adds up to a demand for forces for about 15 or 16. So you're automatically behind the eight ball in meeting what the combatant commanders say, I need to have to do the job I've been told to do. The services then are, and particularly in an era now like with sequestration, where you're very limited in your flexibility of what you can do with the money that you've been given in a continuing resolution, further inhibiting your flexibility. So the services are really behind the eight ball in responding to a demand that far outstrips their ability to supply.
You mentioned sequestration and the constraints that it's imposing on not just personnel and readiness, but everything in the military. And I wonder what difference it would make In especially considering your experience at Fleet Forces Command, if you had the same top line that you get to as a result of sequestration, but you had a regular order budget, not even a CR, right, something that we haven't seen for right. How long has it been, Karen?
A long time.
Right. If you had a regular order budget, what difference would that make in your ability, just not just to the readiness issue that we're discussing, but overall?
It makes a huge difference, and I think Admiral Greenert, our Chief of Naval Operations, explained this beautifully the other day in a public appearance where he talked about what is going to be the impact of operating with sequestration under a clean continuing resolution that has no opportunities to take advantage of all these procurement practices that have been developed. For instance, we are doing multi-year buys on destroyers or our new Virginia-class submarines. Well, under this now, the conditions are operating, the flexibility to execute those multi-years is at risk. And essentially we're going to lose that 10th submarine that is a tremendously good deal for the American taxpayer because of the way the pricing was in the multi-year. So you're going to lose all these gains that we've made over the years in procurement, smart procurement, that Secretary Kendall and Secretary Stackley have been driving to get to, and now it's all in jeopardy. And so this lack of flexibility, I think you hear the service chief saying, okay, I've got it that the budgets are going down. We can still design the kind of force that this nation needs to do what the people expect us to be able to do, but we've got to have the flexibility of a budgeted and appropriation bill.
So I want to bring it up, I guess, a little bit up to the quadrennial review level again. And when you have the day-to-day execution that's happening out there in the services, and then you look at the overall thing that is happening, and there's basic policy when you said, you know, ready for what? There's going to be basic steps. And so I want to bring in the idea of integration with the State Department, because if you take a diplomatic approach first, then that means your readiness, if I'm reading this all right and based on my budget experience, doesn't necessarily have to gear up as soon as you identify a problem, that you could gear that up while the diplomat is trying to work out the problem. So the integration with the State Department, that's going to add another level of complexity based on the resources that are there and how the State Department itself is configured and how it does its resources. And so how well does that work, and how it needs to improve, I would think, going forward?
Yeah, I think in terms of integration, you have these elements of national power, diplomacy, intelligence, the military component, and the nation's economy. Those are kind of the DIME is the acronym. But those are the elements of power that you need to integrate in order to achieve the policy objectives that the president has set out. We saw a great example of what you were talking about when General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker would testify together before Congress on the what's going on in Iraq and what we're intending to do and how we're going to do it. That type of cooperation at that level, at the highest level, is exactly what you're talking about, where the military was totally in sync with the actions that the State Department under Ambassador Crocker were going to be proposing, the policies they're going to try to carry out. And that's exactly the model that has to expand to cover the larger integration piece. And that's, I think, gets more problematic as we expand it in the disparity of resources that a combatant commander has to bring to bear on issues versus an ambassador in a country. And how you do that coordination is very, very difficult when you look at a large number of countries in one of these combatant commanders' regions of area of operations.
Admiral, you wrap this piece by writing, strategic clarity in the determination of our current readiness requirements and the proper resourcing of those requirements will enable the services to answer the three essential readiness questions, and I'll go over those in just a second, and still deliver the force our nation needs today and will need tomorrow, despite the prognosis for continued defense budget declines in the years ahead. That's the three readiness questions are readiness for what, readiness of what, and readiness by when, and for how long. And those are the pieces that you addressed at the beginning of our conversation. The strategic clarity issue, though, is a little bit troublesome to me because it's not just the QDR or the skimmer question that we talked about earlier. It's also the congressional and budget piece that I raised earlier.
Absolutely.
Because DOD can ask for whatever they want, but until they know what they get, they can't do anything.
Yeah, I mean, the president sets the policy objectives for his national security team. That's very clearly done. There's documents that he issues that do that, that then flow through the system to develop, okay, here's the objective. Here's what we need to do to achieve this objective. It needs to be informed by the fiscal reality that the services and the department faces. But you have to have the other guy under the Constitution playing in this to make it all work. Otherwise, you just end up with a bowl of mush, and you're just trying to do the best you can with disparate parts that don't fit together very well because you haven't had the fiscal stability to be able to project ahead. And so if you have this wonderful system working on one hand, but you can't get the Congress to do what the Congress is duty-bound to do by the Constitution, which is pass those appropriation bills, it can't possibly come out with a satisfactory outcome.
Admiral John Harvey is writing Get Real on Military Readiness on the War on the Rocks blog. We have a link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth-admiral, and it's just wonderful to have you on the program.
An
Thank
honor
you very
to be
much
here with
coming.
You. Thank you very much, Karen.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Karen, you know exactly what he's talking about a bowl of mush, don't you?
Yeah, the bowl of mush.
You've dealt with a few of those in your time.
Well, appropriations are critical for the planning and services of all the agencies.